I want to point out, you know, that in every class society that's ever existed, the ruling elements do not rule nakedly. They always adorn their rule with myths or themes and symbols and the like, to justify their privileged positions at the apex of the social pyramid. So the 1% spins its self-legitimating myths. As I said, no ruling class rules nakedly. All of them make up, they take strenuous efforts to justify their rule. I tell students when they say, oh, they don't care what we think, they ignore us and all that. I say, oh, no, no, that's the only thing they care about you. The only thing they care about you is what you're thinking. They don't care if you eat correctly. They don't care how your living conditions are. They don't care that they've built up an inhuman and irrational traffic system that's strangulating us and polluting our air. They don't care about anything. The only thing about you they care about is what you're thinking. In the morning, they start, what's going to be the story today? How do we manipulate? How do we control? How do we contain? How do we influence? How do we act upon what it is that they have in their minds? Modern capitalist societies avoid telling the truth about themselves. Instead, we get those rag-to-riches mythologies, the Horatio Alger stories, myths about fair play, equal opportunity, self-reliance, freedom, liberty, all those kind of things that they feed us again and again, a system that's been so productive and so wonderful and the like. The two fundamental myths of modern corporate capitalism that I want to treat are the myth that capitalism creates a general prosperity and a well-being, material well-being. That's myth number one. Myth number two, that capitalism creates or bolsters democracy. We even hear the phrase capitalist democracies, Western capitalist democracies and the like. Let me start with the one about prosperity. Before I get into that, there's another secondary myth I want to put aside. When I'm talking about capitalism, I'm talking about giant corporate capitalism, okay? I'm not talking about mom and pop small businesses. We're talking about transnational corporations and banks. You know, Lenin himself dealt with that question. He said, 10 million small businesses count for nothing. A few giant cartels count for everything. He was dismissing or thinking less of the small. He was talking in terms of power, where the power is, who's shaping the condition of our lives, who determines the quality of the air we breathe, the food we eat, the water we drink, the kind of jobs we can have, the images we have to deal with and such. That's not mom and pop. So I want to put mom and pop aside and talk about multinational corporate capitalism. The prosperity myth, that it creates prosperity. Corporations have given us wonderful things, and wonderful for them. Consider some consumer realities. The replacement of public nonprofit rail transit systems with polluting expensive automotive transit systems involving billion-dollar highway systems, millions killed or maimed over the decades, who didn't have to be killed or maimed if we had fast bullet, as LA had before General Motors bought up all the tracks, ripped them all up and made people ride buses, and then finally got rid of most of the buses and made people buy their own cars. The replacement of local organic food supplies with pesticide-ridden factory farms, genetically modified foods, antibiotic-ridden meats, shipped long distances. For a long time, this has changed for the better. A tobacco industry, several generations of lung cancer, with you remember that wonderful film of the Senate hearings with the representative, the CEOs from Liggett and Myers and all the other tobacco companies, and each one of them said no caffeine is not addictive and it's no caffeine. They all said that, and they all knew. Meanwhile, the evidence finally came up. They all knew it was addictive, and they all were deliberately injecting more caffeine into the cigarettes so that they would be nicotine. Thank you. Oh, what am I smoking? Okay, nicotine, I mean. I'm glad you're with me. Don't be so picky. Well, they got up. These guys should be in jail. That's called perjury. They lied under oath to Congress. They should be in jail. They never went to jail. But the tobacco industry is unfortunately, cigarette consumption has stopped declining in America. It's kind of leveled off now, and it's increasing dramatically in the third world. What the cigarette companies did is start moving out to the third world. Cigarettes became the cool thing in a lot of other countries, Asia, Africa, places like that. Unsafe at any price. And there's an avalanche of disposable products, cosmetic, medical, whatever, products that keep creating solutions for things that are not problems, trying to get you, convince you that you have this need or that problem and you should buy this and have that. The history of capitalism has been a history of both great prosperity and great poverty. We often note how wealth and poverty, we often say, isn't it how unfortunate that so much wealth here with so much poverty right here, as if it was just an unfortunate juxtaposition. And in fact, it's not at all. It's there's a dynamic interaction between those two things. This poverty exists because of this wealth. This wealth exists because of this poverty. it's a dynamic interrelationship. The wealth of the few rests on the poverty of the many. There could not be epauci, as Cicero called them. Epauci, P-A-U-C-I, Latin it is, it meant the few, the really elite group that ruled the Roman Senate. The Roman senators as such were one thing, but that inner group, the richest, most powerful men run Roman Senate. They could not have ruled and lived the way they want if they didn't, unless they had slaves and proletariat, impoverished people who worked for bare subsistence. There could be no lords and ladies without serfs who labor from dawn to dusk to keep the lords and ladies in the style to which they are accustomed. There could be no corporate capitalists without workers and indentured workers and debtors and taxpayers and all sorts of other people. So there's a real relationship between wealth and poverty. I'll return to that in a minute. I just want to say something else. Do the 1%, that top plutocracy, which you know it's really not 1%, you know that, don't you? 1% would be 3 million people. It's really more like a fraction, about 0.25%. It's about 120,000 people who really compose the super rich and have the wealth of America. And when people say, whoa, you know, that top 1% has as much wealth as the bottom 30 or 40%. That's not true at all. The bottom 30, 40% has nothing. I don't know why people are saying that. Robert Reich, I heard him say that. The 140 richest billionaires have as much wealth as the poorest, 75 million people. The poorest 75 million in America don't have a pot to spit in. Most of them are in debt. Most of them are maxing out on their credit cards. Most of them are just barely getting by. How are you comparing these two? What kind of a dazzling statistic is that supposed to be? But does that 1% believe their own mythologies? Yes, of course, people believe in their own virtue. Yes, of course they believe in their own value to society. Of course, you think Mitt Romney doesn't? He thinks he's God's gift. Well, he's got a special problem with the Mormon stuff and all that. But he thinks he's God's gift to society. For the most part, the class propaganda they put out elevates them, justifies their worth. So why would they not believe it? They find it very persuasive. We all find things very persuasive that are flattering to us, rather things that are critical of us. You don't know what you're talking about. What do you mean? That's what you. But when someone says something that's positive, you say, "Oh, you really think so? Hey, They believe it elevates them. It justifies their wealth. So why would they not believe it? It's very persuasive because it serves their interests. They believe that the poor are the authors of their own poverty. They believe their own wealth is earned and socially useful. It creates jobs. It provides growth. They believe the free market system is the most productive and beneficial in history. They believe competing systems and reforms and government regulations are harmful and distract from the performance of the good things. They believe that government should not be a nanny state tending to the needs of the needy. Let them learn self-reliance, those people down there with their hands out. At the same time, they overlook the fact that their own class is not at all self-reliant. No one is more reliant on government handouts than corporate America. They get tax breaks more than you and I get. They get about $100 billion a year out of every budget in direct subsidies. Everything that they produce is, almost everything is subsidized by the government. They get loan guarantees. They get export subsidies. They get equity grants and land giveaways. They get almost free leases on a lot of government land to do what? Harvest the timber, or mine the copper, or drill for the oil. They get oil. They get oil giveaways practically, or leases, or the land. I mean, it'll be estimated that there's $15 billion worth of oil in a certain reserve on the government land, and they'll lease it. The government will lease it to them for like $500,000 or $1 million peanuts or something, so they can go ahead and take that. That's stealing from the public treasury. The airwaves. They get to lease the airwaves for a song. For a song. Fox News gets to get these airwaves. The airwaves, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, the airwaves are the property of the people of the United States. You'd never know it, though. They're sent out and they're used to great profit by the media corporations and their advertisers and the like. And they get bailouts. They get billion-dollar bailouts. Mom and pop doesn't get a bailout. If things go down, you go out of business, you lose your grocery store, you lose your little cafe, whatever it is. Federal government does not give you a bailout and say, hey, you're too small to fail. Let's give you some more money to boost you up here a little bit. That doesn't happen. Well, big corporate capitalism, besides being hypocritical, self-deluding, and deluding us, is also an irrational system. Marx said it was a ruthlessly rational system that demystified and shattered the Dark Ages. You know, there's that incredible paragraph in the Communist Manifesto where Marx and Engels talk about the dynamic, productive energy of capitalism, and how it broke loose from the shackles of 1,000 years of the Dark Ages. And if you read, you know, and if you read the Enlightenment writers, I had a book of the book, an anthology of the Enlightenment. I started reading them. I was so struck. I mean, I was just so struck by how naively enthusiastic they are. I mean, just the like a Ben Franklin or people like that. They were just there at the edge, knowing that the world was opening up. And I said, I've got to be a little more generous to these guys. They're coming down from 1,000 years of the Dark Ages. They're coming down from a civilization that condemned the Paris Medical Society and the medical school in Paris for what? You know what they condemned Paris for? Empiricism. They said, Paris medicine suffers from empiricism. This was back during the time of Louis XIV, Louis XIV or so. That empiricism, that is, they were doing things like cutting open cadavers and looking and learning what the body really was about and where it was and what happened and doing that sort of thing, rather than using the Bible as its authority for judging why someone is sick, and there are four humors, there are five this, and there are seven that, and you make these old superstitious deductions, and then you gave the guy whatever it is, the eyeballs of a frog and to eat, or and he had to say 10 Our Fathers, and that would make him better. So the people of the Enlightenment are coming down from that, and the whole world is opening up. And Marx is pointing out, from the late 18th century right up to his day, which is the middle of the 19th century, in that 60 years, they saw all sorts of sciences emerging. They saw continents being subdued, canals being dug, the canals then being ignored because they were building railroads now across stretches of land. And they saw this incredible burgeoning of mills and mines and all this sort of dynamic explosion. So this, Marx says, is really a very impressive thing. It is. But it becomes irrational in its social relations. I would also add that capitalism is amazingly irrational in regard to the environment. It explicitly ignores the environment, if you know what I mean. And it doesn't really ignore environmentalism. It's more than ignoring environmentalism. It condemns environmentalism. It attacks it. It has pejorative terms like tree huggers, and what are some of those other terms? Eco-terrorists, right? Eco-terrorists. What are they talking about? They're the eco-terrorists. So they're irrational in regard to the environment. They treat the environment, first of all, they treat it and its resources as limitless, and that's incorrect. We now know most of our topsoil is almost gone, and the environment is not limitless. That's one. And they also treat the environment as disposable. It's a disposable environment. You can use up some stuff here and turn it all into wasteland and toss it aside and move on to somewhere else and do the same. Capitalism's crises are not exceptional. They are the common mode. In other words, under modern corporate capitalism, the irrational, the wasteful, the destructive, the impoverishing, all of that is the norm. Normal, balanced, productive, calm, equitable social relations and periods are the exception. Crises, panics, recession, crises again, that's the norm of capitalism. In the late 1780s, we had debtor rebellions in America. Shays Rebellion, the best known one maybe, but others too. After the American Revolution, we had monetary crises. Then there was the Panic of 1792. The Panic of 1809, which lasted a number of years. The Panic of 1819. The Panic of 1837. Let's skip the rest of the 19th century. You can go on to the very end of the century. That decade of 1890, where the economy, the U.S. already was the leading manufacturing country in the world. And yet, that whole decade, 1890s, they couldn't pull out of the recession. They were having a tough time. Teddy Roosevelt said, "We need a war, any war, let's have a war." They were looking for a war, I mean, very explicitly, war would do two things. One, it would stimulate the economy and get it going. And two, it would distract people from their economic grievances and get them flag waving, which indeed it did with the Spanish-American War. All through the 20th century, wars and recessions. We know the 1920s as the jazz age, you know, Charleston, oh, and things were great. The 1920s were a period of severe recession, especially in agrarian areas, less so in the cities. After that came the Great Depression, as you know, 1929, and that lasted right on up to 1941 when World War II began. All through the 20th century, we've had wars, recessions, inflation, market crashes, investor panics, depressions, massive deficits, bubbles and bailouts and subsidies. Hardly a normal year. When you got the free market, that market ain't so free. It is a system that can never settle with itself. The corporate crimes and crises we endure are not irrational departures from a rational system. It's not that this is an irrational time or a crazy time. It's the converse, just the converse of that. They are the rational outcomes of a basically amoral and irrational system. When you've got that kind of system, this is what you're going to get. It's not that these are just some deviancies, some real bad things, some Bernie Madoffs did this and now it's all upset and all that. No, that doesn't work. The system puts forth these people and rewards them tremendously. John Maynard Keynes, the liberal, the guru of liberal capitalism, and Keynes is looking pretty good nowadays, but it's hard to, with the free market. The free market orthodoxy prevails in much of academia in economic departments that you can't even read Keynes anyway. It makes a lot of sense. He made this point. Now, he was the guru of liberal capitalism, but he was not his shill. He wasn't his shill. He was not selling it. He was quite critical of capitalism. And he said, quote, "What an astonishing idea that the most wickedest of men," he uses a double superlative there. He uses bad grammar to be cute, to sort of emphasize the point. He says, "What an astonishing idea that the most wickedest of men, doing the most wickedest of things, will produce beneficial results." That's what he was saying. When the Depression came, he said, "Whatever could you possibly have thought was going to happen if you leave these people to be doing all this stuff?" People who are not known for their human empathy or their willingness to sacrifice and share. And even if they were known for that, they seem to lose it once they get into this game. Corporate America and both of its major parties and both political parties are in the service of corporate America. The leader of the Democratic Party, Barack Obama, in the debate just last week with Romney, made his profession to the free enterprise capitalist system. He said that. You know, he's very explicitly made that point. They're wedded to a system that brings poverty and hard times and attrition. Most of the world is capitalist, and most of the world is poor. Capitalist Nigeria, capitalist Indonesia, capitalist Mexico, capitalist Thailand, capitalist South Africa. I said, capitalism creates immense prosperity for a few, but it creates immense poverty. And here it is. All of these capitalist countries, they're usually not even thought of as capitalist countries, isn't that right? They're just thought of as third world countries. No, they're capitalists. They're big companies that are in there, and they hire people, and they got mines and mills and whatever else. And as capitalism spreads and grows all over these worlds, so does poverty. The number of people living in poverty is growing at a faster rate than the world's population. Did you get that? So that poverty is spreading, in other words, spreading even as wealth accumulates. Even in the United States, in 1900, the United States was a third world country, 50 years before the term was invented. We had typhoid epidemics in Philadelphia and Baltimore and places like that. We had chronic and mass underemployment, chronic and mass poverty. We had all that sort of stuff, all the diseases of poverty too, tuberculosis, malnutrition, rickets, and the like. I remember as a kid, tuberculosis and rickets, and all those were still diseases to be dealt with. The great American prosperity, America as the land of prosperity, is a myth. It didn't exist. The Great Depression came along. At the same time, Western Europe, those great, wonderful social democracies like Finland and Denmark and Norway and Sweden, and where life and social services have been better for a while, they were third world countries too. People were living hard and mean lives in those countries too. World War II brought a massive increase in spending in America. There are three things that led to the American prosperity that came. That prosperity started developing 1945, 46, 47, in the 1940s. And that came for three things as I see it. One was the great backlog of consumer demand. An interesting thing started happening when World War II came. All sorts of people started making money. I have an uncle, Nick, he was a mechanic, a working class guy. I come from an Italian working class family in New York, East Harlem, which was a big Italian neighborhood in those days. Uncle Nick worked in a garage. He made about $40 a week, which was good money in those days for blue collar working class people. When the war came, he quit being an auto mechanic, and he, first of all, there were many, many less automobiles on the road. Nobody had automobiles. He went to work in an arms factory and was making $100 a week. I mean, $100 a week was unbelievable. The problem was there was nothing to spend it on. Oh, he went to nightclubs and did things and all that. But even he had a surplus in this lifestyle. You couldn't buy cars because Detroit was now making tanks and planes and the like. You couldn't buy new refrigerators. You had to keep your old one if you had a refrigerator. Many people still had ice boxes with ice in it. My family did, and the like. But what it did was, everybody said, when this war is over, there'll be a depression. In other words, we'll be back to the way it was in the 30s. When the war was over, you had this backlog of consumer demand. People wanting things and having saved up money from all the jobs they had during the war. Because the government was spending and spending in a way that some of this just trickled down, did get around. This was the kind of money they could not spend it during the Depression itself. They couldn't spend that much, but they could spend it for war and killing. The second thing that happened, besides this great backlog of people wanting homes too, and as I say, all these durable consumer goods and the like, payments. Public utilities owned by local governments offer rates averaging 20% less than those charged by private power companies that operate for profits. That's socialism in action. What do you have here? Do you have a public utility or a private? What? I can't hear you. We're having an election right now for a public one?
Yes.
Very good. That's great. The most expensive one is PG&E, where I live in Northern California. PG&E spent $2 million in lobbying and transferred $5.1 billion in profits to the most affluent stockholders and executive heads over a three-year period. That's capitalism in action. But now let's look at some public utilities. The one in Palo Alto transferred $7.3 million to their local government budget. PG&E transferred zero to the California state budget in Palo Alto. The LA Public Utility transferred $124 million to their local governments. That's socialism in action. They made money. They not only gave you lower rates, but the money they made, they put into the budget, which would then keep your taxes down and help you. PG&E has given nothing back to the communities. It all goes to their stockholders and such. The capitalist leaders want to eliminate public spending programs, not because they don't work, but because they do. That's why they want to get rid of public utilities. They work fine. They demonstrate that this thing could be done cheaper and at greater return for the public and such. That's why they're destroying the U.S. Postal Service and inflicting upon it a terrible... go to Common Dreams, and Jim Hightower has a good article on the post office. The post office isn't going broke. It's not dwindling. It's handling more mail today than it ever did even before the internet. It may not as much first class mail, but an awful lot of junk mail and such and the other stuff. But I call it junk mail. I mean, it serves some service sometimes. But they've been forced to raise $5 billion a year for a pension fund for workers that haven't even been born yet. It's for the next 70 years they're supposed to finance this thing. It's a way, literally, of underfinancing and stripping and destroying the U.S. Postal Service, and that's what they're doing. And they're doing that because it works. You tell me what private postal service... What private postal service in this country will deliver door to door from here to New Jersey, let's say, a piece of mail to my Aunt Tessie, me, for 45 cents? What private company will do that? Nobody. You know what your mail will cost if you want to send somebody a birthday card or something? Well, you won't. You're going to send it over the internet. But there are people who still do that. It's going to cost quite a bit. And that's what's wrong. That is, any kind of service that outperforms the public, that outperforms the private corporations, shall be attacked. And that's why Social Security is being attacked, that's why Medicare is being attacked, and so forth. These represent threats to profit markets. So, let me just tell you about, as far as the environment goes, there was a cartoon in the New Yorker a year ago. It showed a guy at a business meeting. You know, he had a lectern here, and there was the tables, and people were all sitting there, and there were all the charts in the back and all. And he's saying to the business meeting, he's saying, "So while the end of the world scenario will be rife with unimaginable horrors, we believe that the pre-end period will be filled with unprecedented opportunities for profit." And that's where they are. That's why I call it a pathology. These guys are crazy. I mean, this thing is happening right before their eyes. The Arctic is melting. Years ago, I said, they're not going to wake up until the North Pole itself melts. I didn't say Arctic. I said the North Pole. Well, the North Pole is melting away and out. And what are they doing? They're going, "Oh, we can get at the oil that's under there, the very oil and fossil consumption that's causing all this to it. Oh, we'll have a Northwest Passage, finally, as old as Lewis and Clark, over 100 years. We're now, the dream was always to find a Northwest Passage to the Pacific, you know? But now we could have it. No more going through the Isthmus, no more going all the way down Cape Horn or anything. Now we can just, we'll be able to cut." And they've got corporations developing whose specialty is to show other corporations how to make money with global warming, you see. They're crazy. And so I had this image I pointed out. I said, just imagine that everybody in the world was in this bus, a very large bus, and we're hurtling down this road, and is going to plunge off a cliff. You know what these guys will be doing? They'll be running up and down the aisle selling us seat belts at very inflated prices, because they're very inflated prices. And that's where they are. They're crazy. It's a rational pursuit of irrational ends becomes itself, the pursuit itself becomes irrational. And these people themselves, although they sound perfectly rational, are part of this pathology. And our job is to grab control of the bus, turn it around, get these guys off the aisles, maybe open the door, throw them out. Slow down first when you throw them out. And the like. I leave you with this. Someone wrote this on the internet, and I couldn't find out the party's name, but it was something like this, actually. I'm rephrasing it. Quote, "What an incomprehensible, insane world it seemed to me, until I realized that it was ruled by rapacious, money-mad sociopaths. Then it all made sense." And that's what I tried to do here now, was have it all make sense in the hope that we can bring good sense to triumph over self-driven greed and pathology. Thank you very much.